This podcast will look back at some of the most pressing developments in Lebanon over the past 3 years, and will unpack how political instability, economic collapse, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the Beirut port explosion has affected hundreds of thousands of families across the country and their quality of life. It will also look at how NGOs and advocates like Impact Lebanon and Save the Children and Nadine Lebake are trying to create a better future for the next generation.
Impact Lebanon did not exist until 2019, at the end of 2019. But do you remember anything from that year? Were you involved with any sort of initiatives in Lebanon at the time?
Yes, of course. So around the year 2018, it started to go downwards a bit economically in the country. And yes, Impact Lebanon wasn't born just yet, but the same group of people, we were getting together in London, just always thinking of ways of trying to make things a bit better locally for the local population, be it through helping through education or helping with livelihoods or helping just with the exchange rate changes. So the initiatives weren't as concrete as they are now. But yes, we obviously, the same group of people was getting together and starting to think of ways of helping, and it would be different ways every time. Sometimes we would do art sales and try to promote local artists abroad, and sometimes it would be cooking Lebanese food for the diaspora or for European friends, and then raising money and try to send it locally. So yeah, initiatives were starting to bubble up a bit.
Absolutely. I remember noticing some of that as well. The economy hasn't, you know, collapsed at that point as we're seeing it right now. But you could see that there were a lot of cracks and there's a lot of tension and people were really worried about what could happen. Unemployment began to increase. That was really noticeable as well. And I recall speaking with lots of families who started to say that they're worried about their long-term sustainability. And I recall lots of young people as well saying that they're not willing to sort of invest their efforts and time into the country because they don't see any sort of sustainability long-term. And I think people were really scared at the time. There was no visual evidence at that point, but things were definitely shaky at the time. I wanted to ask if Save the Children were sort of recognizing a greater need for sort of cash assistance programs, whether from Lebanese or Syrian refugees or any vulnerable community in the country, of course, and whether there was sort of a greater need to support families in their livelihoods.
فجمعية إنقاذ الطفل كانت عم تستجيب من قبل 2018 وخلال 2018 كنا بعدنا عم نكفي البرامج يلي هي سابقا كانت موجودة مثل برنامج المأوى وحماية الطفل وبرنامج التعليم وأيضا البرامج الأخرى. فكل احتياجات يلي بتظهر جديدة بنكون عم نعمل مسح لهذه الاحتياجات نقدر نستجيب لها. أما بخصوص التعليم يعني تحت كل قطاع صحيح ان قطاعات منفصله بالاسم او بالاختصاص لكن كل الخدمات اللي بنقدمها هي بتكون شامله وبيكون البرنامج الواحد موجود فيه عدة خدمات. مثلا إذا عنا ولد بحاجة لخدمة التعليم هو تحت خطر التسرب بنقدم له خدمة التعليم وأيضا بتم مواكبته من فريق حماية الطفل وبتم أيضا من فريق سبل العيش Food Security and Livelihood مسح الاحتياجات الموجودة بالعائلة لحتى تقدم الخدمة بشكل متكامل.
And Nadine, 2018 was the year you released Kfar Nahum, your film, which was received with accolades internationally. Did the economic instability, let's say in Lebanon at the time, inspire you? Or maybe other sort of vulnerable communities that we began to see increase in numbers at the time?
By the time I started working on Capernaum, it was actually in 2013. I started researching because obviously I could see the result, or I could see the sort of collapse that was going to happen. Because it was very tangible from everything you see around you. And it was especially tangible when you see children working, when you see children that are not in school, children working, selling flowers or working in a as a delivery boy in a supermarket. And this was a sight we used to encounter back then very, very frequently. It was whether they were Lebanese children or refugee children, this sight was very frequent. So I think it at that point, it said a lot about what was going to happen and where we stood at that moment, and how our systems were failing. It was not only about children. I started maybe the story or the research started because I wanted to know more about the behind the scenes. Who are those children? Where do they go? Who are their families? And then when you start researching, you understand that it's much bigger than that, that everything is sort of intertwined, and you start understanding so much about these whole, you know, neighborhoods and belts of misery that are surrounding our cities. And even if sometimes we choose not to look because the problem is too big, the problem was very, 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 you know, near and close to our lives. And so I started understanding more and more about how difficult our situation is and how very close to the collapse we are, because obviously I met lots of families. I went to the most unfortunate neighborhoods and spoke to many people, spent so much time in courts. I used to spend days and hours just in random courts in Lebanon. I used to go there and just sit down and watch and see what was happening. And when you see how much the justice system is a zoo, unfortunately, in Lebanon. Even, I mean, a zoo is much more organized than how our justice system works. And I what makes me truly believe in us as Lebanese is really our humanity. I think this was the only thing that kept us going, is really our humanity. I was inspired, yes, by what inspired me, and what inspired me to speak was how much we have adapted as a population to this injustice, whether it was injustice toward a child who is begging on the street, or whether it was an injustice towards a migrant worker that is, you know, treated as a criminal just because she or he doesn't have, you know, papers, or it becomes illegal, therefore becomes a criminal, and therefore is treated like a criminal in prisons that are not even, you know, worse than hell, you know, worse than. So it was this whole, you know, awareness of what was really surrounding us that made me want to make this film and dive deeper in our systemic chaos. It's a complete systemic chaos that is not finding any solutions for the most underprivileged in our country.
It's interesting, Nadine, you said you've been observing all these you know, children working where they shouldn't be when they should be schooled back in 2013. And yeah, that just goes to show how the cracks start early on, but the problem is long-standing.
And it's starting long ago. I mean, it's starting long before 2013. It's been happening for decades. It's just that we became aware of it because obviously of the collapse, and also the revolution played a big role in us understanding how much our system is, and it's also the help system that was created for the people in need, that also helped us understand more and more, because we started understanding what other people's needs are, and also the collapse of the fact that we are now all in that same situation, because everybody's money now is trapped in banks. This is what actually was a big wake-up call for all of us, because we were personally hit. And that's also another absurdity of you know, human nature. It's only when you are personally affected by the suffering that you become aware of other people's suffering, unfortunately. But this has been happening for a very, very, very long time. I mean, it's been happening for decades, but nobody spoke about it. Nobody wanted to see.
Yeah.
These are neighborhoods that just like are 3 minutes away from where we live most of the time. So we didn't want to see.
Very interesting, because you said that we choose, like you said earlier, we choose not to think about it, although they're around the corner. But when 2019 happened, then it started affecting us, and it started affecting people that you thought were safe and far away from these problems. And then we realized that actually it's really not that far. That whole world that you were mentioning, Nadine, it's really around the corner, and it really can attain anyone.
I do agree completely. And it's interesting because there was just enough sort of semblance of normality to make it seem like things were going to collapse. But at the same time, as Nadine said, this goes back decades. So you think of, you know, the lack of proper investment and building of social infrastructure, education, healthcare, social security, child protection, pension plans. None of these things really existed. And I think in the years preceding 2019, we began to recognize through the children and the youth the decline in their quality of life and opportunities, which were, you know, the early cracks, as you said, that something is not going to work out, because youth unemployment began to skyrocket, access to education began to diminish, child labor, access to healthcare. So all these things start to get worse over time. So it's completely true. But I think the whole time there was sort of semblance of stability. And I think that's what prevented some sort of alarmism among so many people here. Basically, if you have noticed that in the years prior to 2019, when the economic crisis started to sort of emerge, if you've noticed that there has been a greater need for capacity to support beneficiaries.
بال 2019 لاحظنا انه عمليه الاطفال عم بتزيد, وايضا الزواج المبكر والحاجه الى خدمات الحمايه, لانه خاصه بالبرامج التربويه وقتها نلحظ غياب متكرر, حالات عنف عم بتزيد على الاطفال, ان كان بقلب البيت ام بالشارع وين ما بيروحوا بيشتغلوا. هذا الشيء كان اول دافع لانه نبلش نبحث عن الخدمات اللي لازم نعطيها, ونزيد اكثر البرامج يلي خاصه بالحمايه. وايضا بالارقام نفرج انه هذا الشيء مش شايفينه او مش موجود, لا موجود وعم يعلى. يعني هو مش بس موجود, هو موجود وعم يعلى, وعم يخسروا هالاطفال الحق بالتعليم ليروحوا يشتغلوا ويامنوا قوت يومهم او لا يساعدوا اهلهم. وايضا الفتيات بتم جبره على الزواج لحتى الاهل بمحل أم المقدم الرعاية يكون عم بيخفف العبء المادي بنظرهم. وهذا الشيء منه بيئة آمنة للأطفال يعيشوا فيها, وما بيأسس لجيل متعلم وآخذ حقوقه. هو ما يعني كل ما كانت البيئة غير آمنة للأطفال موجودين فيها, كل ما بتكتر أصلا بتزيد الأزمات. بصير عندك تسرب من المدرسة, أطفال منهم متعلمين, طفل بقلب الشارع وقت يروح يشتغل هو مش بس عم بيجيب مردود, هو صحيح عم بيروح يشتغل لكن عم يخسر حقه بالتعليم وحقه بأنه يحصل على حياة سليمة, وعم يتعرض فوق لشتى أنواع العنف بمحل ما بيكون موجود.
So basically, if the conditions for children are not secure and safe, then children only have it worse with every generation, because it gets worse over time.
يعني من 2018 ل 2019, وكل ما تزيد هيدا الحالات, أنت you will need to scale up the area of intervention. Advocate more, and هذا رقم مخيف.
بعدين the different ways of advocating. مثلا أول شيء عندي كنبلش إنه
domestic violence بعدين صار
وين بال 2019
لا لا عم بقلك انه انت عم تقولك انت انه there's different ways now you can
لا لأنه هي العنف على الولد مش بس بالشارع أو فيكون بالمدرسة كمان يعني فيكون بقلب المدرسة فيكون عنصرية فيكون تنمر فيكون بالحي فيكون وين ما كان إذا البيئة منا آمنة domestic abuse ما بيدوى عليها إلا إذا كانت particular يعني بنقول أنه عنف منزلي that's it بتحطيها بس advocacy wise ب domestic violence هو تشتغلي مع العائلة دغري فرق ما تكوني بس عم بتلوميهم لأنه أنت هيدي حلقة العنف المتواصلة على الوضع الاقتصادي على هي أكيد منا مبرر بس إذا تقويت وأدرست لأنه هو ما في سيستم بيشتغل عليها ما عندك موارد ف
بعدين it's the education يعني إذا هن الأهل they went through domestic abuse and they see this as normal they put their children through
هي it. لأنه ما عندهم ما عندهم سلوك بديل ما عندهم البديل لا يتعاملوا معه هيدي البرامج هي اللي بتساعد الأهل والطفل لأنه ما بتستهدفي بس الطفل بتستهدفي كل السيركل تاعه إن كان من policies إن كان من أهله بالبيت إن كان من التيتشرز اللي عم بيعلموه أو فريق الحماية المتواجد معه وكل شيء حواليه بمدرسة ببيت ببلد هي منا بس الأهل.
So in 2019, the Lebanese economy began to become shaky. The currency was no longer stable as it once was. Banks began to impose very strict withdrawal limits on people's money. And that caused a huge panic. People were not willing to spend as much as before. And this is when there was sort of popular uprising, protests across the country, demanding that someone puts an end to this and that things have to change so people can live in a decent economy and protect themselves and their children to make sure that they're secured with livelihoods and good standards of living. But at the same time, the economy continued to spiral and things began to visibly get worse for so many families in Lebanon. But also in 2019, this was when Impact Lebanon was formed. Agatha, if you want to talk a little bit more about how it was formed and what were some of the first initiatives you worked on to support people during this difficult time?
Around on the 19th of October, which is 2 days after the Thawra, the 17th of October 2019 here in Lebanon, there was a protest in London in support. We started just as a group of people who want to try and help Lebanon in every way possible, because we're aware that we've left, but we're also aware that we living abroad allows you to have certain resources that you can put to good use and use as to reinvest those, be it time, be it financial resources, be it knowledge, be it access to education or anything else. And you could use that in a way to invest it and try to bring it back, to bring back value in Lebanon. Of course, Impact Lebanon started, I know we gained the global reach around the Beirut explosion, which is when we started our disaster relief fundraiser. However, as you mentioned, Impact Lebanon had started before that, and we'd started to, as we call it, an initiative hub. So it's us who just try to find people who want to help Lebanon in any way they want. So it could be educational, cultural, political, any way possible, and then we try to put them in teams together so that they can turn these ideas into tangible initiatives which have an impact on the ground. And so to answer your question, some of the initiatives that we started were Environmental Academy, which is one of our first initiatives, and that was to help with wastewater and the big dam construction around Bisri and many different things where we wanted to help environmentally. And then we've got cultural initiatives like Terbi Lab, which aims to kind of celebrate and give more awareness to Lebanese people about their own history and culture. And we've got Juzuri, which is also a way of unifying, celebrating what it is to be Lebanese around the world. And then we've got educational initiatives like EduPact, which helps to give quality education to disadvantaged children in Lebanon. And of course, we've got SOTI, which is a political initiative, which aims, obviously, it's equidistant from all the parties, but the purpose is to try to raise awareness and push people, motivate them to be more active citizens and to be more engaged in the civic life and to know more about how the system, the political system works, and to feel like they can make a difference, and then to learn more about the alternative parties if you want to vote alternative sometimes and you don't know who for. So just to informational like that. And of course, we have other initiatives that are a one-off, not long-standing, like Mental Health Week, Culture Week, which is coming up soon, and Keyboards for Lebanon, where we sent laptops to people who couldn't have access to laptops in Lebanon. And there is a few initiatives.
That's quite a lot of initiatives, yeah. And I think it's interesting because, you know, at the same time, when the economy started to shake, there was sort of a more collective awareness or interest in becoming more aware about why their economy is functioning the way it is. And this was an opportunity to create more, you know, civic engagement in the country. But at the same time, unfortunately, we've also seen how quality of life has declined so quickly. And I said earlier, Ala, that child labor has already been on the rise. And now we're seeing that more and more children are having to work because their families that were able to survive and get by now can't even afford to keep their kids in school because there aren't many viable public options, or because there's been lots of informal price hikes. So if they want to buy food, it's more of a burden. Plus, they have their money stuck in the banks. So I was interested in sort of hearing what were some of the interventions that Save the Children did during this sort of early period of panic.
ببداية 2019 كنا كتير عم نلحظ ازدياد بحالات عمالة الأطفال من خلال المراكز الموجودة الميدانية على الأرض. بتذكر في عنا كان مركز الأولاد نحن منقدم بخدم بالخدمة التربوية أو التعليمية سناكس. فكان في مجموعة من الأولاد تجي بس لتنطر وقت الأكل. يعني أنت مش بس عم تحكي إنه الأولاد ما عم يشتغلوا، الأولاد ما عندهم أكل يأكلوه، ما قدرانين يحصلوا على خدمة التعليم لأنه يعني منا الخدمة هي متساوية للجميع، وما بيقدروا يتسجلوا أنه بدهم يروحوا يشتغلوا. وأيضا غير يعني هو العنف على الأطفال، ومش بس لعمالة الأطفال، عندك وجودهم بالشارع، عندك وجودهم ببيئة غير آمنة من خلال إذا ما عندهم بيت يقعدوا فيه أو عائلة تقدر تحضنهم أو العائلة حتى منها آمنة. فالفرق اللي عنا كانت عم تستجيب لهذه الاحتياجات عبر خدمات متكاملة. بحال لتسي طفل بيشتغل، بيجي فريق حماية الطفل بيعمل تقييم أو مسح احتياجات للعائلة وبيحطوا خطة إدارة حالة. يعني مش مساعدة هي دغري، بدها تكون متكافئة والأهل موجودين ضمن دائرة هذه الخدمات، لأنه أحيانا الأهل ما عندهم البديل لمعرفة التعامل مع الأطفال، أو ممكن يكون الاحتياج هو مادي. يعني ممكن الاحتياج يكون بس ليقدروا يأمنوا هالحاجات الأساسية يلي بالأزمات ما بقى بتفكر بمجال التعليم. وهون دورنا أنه بهيدي بأي أزمة نكون عم نحط خطط استجابة لاحتياجات الطفل، مش بس فقط خطط استجابة الطفل منه مشارك فيها أو منه عاطي رأيه فيها وبتكون رائزة أو أساسها هو فقط لأنه عم نقدم خدمة. لا، بدها تكون الخطة متكاملة وبتستجيب لأحتياج هذا الطفل. عنا فريق أيضا حماية الطفل يلي هو بيقدم مثل برامج دعم نفسي اجتماعي، إن كان بشكل فردي أم بشكل مجموعات بقلب الصفوف. وطبعا من هي جميع العاملين في المراكز، إن كان من معلمين معلمات أشخاص متواجدين حوالين الأطفال، إنه يقدروا يرصدوا هيدا الاحتياجات أو يرصدوا الحالات لحتى نتدخل بشكل مبكر ومندرب هالكادر الموجود على الأرض بكيفية رصد هيدا الحالات. لأنه أحيانا ما بتبين، يعني في الولد أو الطفل يكون عم يجي لعنا على المركز ليأخذ خدمة التعليم لكن ما منعرف انه هو عم يشتغل او هي عم تشتغل، عم في خطر للزواج المبكر. فكل ما اهلت هالكادر الموجود معك لانه يرصد هذه الحالات، كل ما نقدر نستجيب لها بشكل اسرع. وكل هيدي الداتا او هيدي الارقام هي مش لتجمع رقم، هي لتأرجي بالارقام انه فعليا الحالات عم تزداد بشكل غير منطقي، وبشكل ما بتقدر حتى الموارد الموجودة عندك انك تغطيها او تستجيب لكل حاجة. يعني بيكون عنا على لائحة الانتظار بنفس الارقام المسجلة عنا، بيكون عنا على قدهم على لائحة الانتظار ليستفيدوا من خدمة التعليم الحماية والى اخره.
And something that I've noticed actually was, you know, when speaking to children who work, you know, years prior to the crisis, you know, of course they work in pretty abysmal conditions, and you speak to them and their families, and a lot of the time it has to do with the fact that, you know, they cannot afford to access education, or their public schools are just too full, they're not taking in more kids because they don't have good investment in public schools in Lebanon. But now not only are we seeing an increase in child labor, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, but I've noticed that even the worst forms of child labor has increased for sure. Because if you have a, you know, a child who is working at a place which is, let's say, not as prone to abuse as in other places, you know, these places are impacted by the economic crisis. And what you often see is that children and women, but, you know, children as well, are more prone to violence and abuse in these spaces. Or children could be laid off because if they're working at a barbershop, for example, or at a grocery store, because they don't want to pay their salary anymore, which means that their options are far more limited into working in much more abusive kind of environments. And it really does show how, you know, I think, and I feel very strongly about this, it's that if the economic policies actually were built on investing in social protections in everybody and guaranteeing the right to education, healthcare for everybody, then this hike in child labor, I don't think we would have seen it. Nadine, I wanted to turn to you and I wanted to ask if you could tell me about some of the things that you worked on, if you felt that it was sort of enough, what we've seen in general. Do you think there could have been more increased work to support working children and their families? Given that you followed this for so long, whether it was with your film or as somebody who has been an advocate for human rights and children's rights, what's your take on that?
You know, it's obviously the work never stops because it's such a big problem, and it doesn't have one solution. Always had this dream, you know, of coming up with this huge master plan with the communities that are directly affected, with the different NGOs, with the government, and really to tackle the problem even before a child is born. Because I've noticed, unfortunately, sometimes those kids are doomed even before they are born. I've met many, many mothers who were pregnant who used to tell me, anyway, this child is not going to be mine because I will put him or her in an orphanage as soon as they are 6 months, because I won't be able to feed them and I won't be able to raise them. So the journey to hell starts even before the child is born. And then they are born and the family does not have enough resources to actually register the child. So the child becomes stateless, because after a year, if the child is not registered, it costs a lot of money and lots of, you know, different interventions for the child to be able to be registered. So because of another time, lack of money, the child will become invisible from the system and will live all his life in this invisible status, because the child won't be able to go to school because he doesn't have papers. He won't be able to work. He won't be able to travel. He or she won't be able to have a normal life. They will live an ongoing state of standby on the fringes of our society. So it's a problem that should be really tackled from the start, you know, from the beginning. And it's a whole systemic reshuffling that should be done in order to really be able to find solutions, or at least tackle the problems from all these different angles: education, registration, nutrition, abuse. There isn't one solution, and the problem is really huge. This is why I was saying it never ends. Only supporting financially the families or the people who are the most in need is not enough. The schooling system, education should be free for everyone. And the access to education should be free for everyone. When I go back to your question regarding advocacy, I made a film trying to shed the light on the problem, but there's still a lot to do.
Absolutely. And when you look at, for example, our education system or even our healthcare system, I mean, they are mostly private institutions that aren't free. And the public ones barely get any investment whatsoever. If you look at the budget allocations, they're very minimal. So you're almost, I mean, there's no, I think as a government, one ought to incentivize people to go to school, to have access to healthcare, no matter how vulnerable you are. But unfortunately, we don't see that. We see lots of private schools and private hospitals, and regardless of how fantastic they are, they're just not for everybody because not everybody can afford them. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Issues related to the living conditions of children and child labor and all the negative consequences and coping mechanisms that come with children and households in these vulnerable economic communities are all rooted in systematic economic policy. If you provide the infrastructure that keeps them in school and keeps healthcare available for the family and reduces all these other costs, which are basically a human right. I mean, at this point, they are human rights. Then most of these negative consequences, I think, would have been reduced at this point, unfortunately. And, you know, that being said, it only got worse in 2020 when COVID, you know, hit Lebanon, and Lebanon went under lockdown in mid-March, and many families were, you know, very confused as to what to do because work stopped and everybody was being paid because people were being paid, you know, just per hour rather than like a proper contract. There's also the matter of whether to stay in school or not because the crisis only got worse. But for so many people, education was very difficult because some schools, for example, would go digital. But I remember speaking to teachers saying that not even the teachers themselves had laptops to do the Zoom. So they would share laptops. I spoke to a teacher in Tripoli, said teachers would share laptops. Not all the families could afford, you know, all the stationery at this point. So some teachers out of their own pocket would buy the stationery from public schools. And this is considering that the local currency has started to devaluate at this point, which means prices have gone up. And most institutions, including government institutions and private institutions, were not adjusting the salary to account for inflation, which means that everything became more expensive and the amount of money people made became less. I remember speaking to a family, for example, that only had one cell phone at home and three kids and no laptop, which means that when kids had to do class on Zoom, they'll have to share this one phone. So I wanted to interview the mother. And she said, well, my kids have class from like 9 to 3, but then we could speak at 4 because I'll have the phone by then. And this shows how difficult it was to keep kids in school and to keep them in safe environments that will not stagnate their education. And I guess at this point, this is where I guess we can talk about EduPact. And I think this is where if you'd like to tell us a bit more about it.
So EduPact is an initiative of Impact Lebanon that is aimed at making quality education accessible for disadvantaged children in Lebanon. And then not only that, but also ensuring their safety during that education. And then advocating for reforms in the educational system. EduPact is aimed at matching teachers who have undergone and will undergo safeguarding training from Save the Children, which is a brilliant collaboration that's taking place. And through that, we will be able to help the children to kind of catch up on the education that they've had to miss out on through, you know, these extra sessions that they're going to be having with teachers that will be volunteering under EduPact in Back Lebanon.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, making sure that children were able to have some sort of access to education at that point and to sort of prevent this increased dropout. It was crucial at the time because not only was that happening, but with the Lebanese pound or Lebanese lira sort of losing its value further, we began to witness a food security crisis, something that we never thought would ever happen in Lebanon. I mean, I remember at that point, we're a country that imports almost everything, even our food products, even the things that we have to import to make food, the raw materials for packaging and so on. But at the time, there's lots of fear that things like bread, which was subsidized, would start to change its price, and other food items would increase because, you know, the dollar shortage means that it's harder to import, it's more expensive. And this was something that I think nobody really expected, you know, that Lebanon, which generally is a middle-income country, would never have an issue where people cannot buy food the way they once did.
Yeah, I agree.
And this was very concerning because a lot of the backbone of how our food prices, food item prices are relatively stable comes from the economic system, where we have, for example, the pegged currency of the Lebanese pound to the dollar, 1,500 to the dollar. That's how we kept it. The subsidies on wheat. We import wheat that is subsidized to make sure that a 900 gram a bundle of bread is at a certain price, which is affordable to most households. But now we're realizing that because the costs have become more expensive to maintain the bakeries, to pay the workers so they can live a decent life, has increased. And there was a lot of tension as to what's going to happen. Unfortunately, we saw that for the first time, I think it was in June, that the price of bread went up. And since then, it's gone up quite a bit. And, you know, we unfortunately today have one of the highest food inflations in the world. We've exceeded 400%, I think, in February. And this is something that, you know, really gets in the way, I think, of, you know, children's performance in schools, their ability to access education. I mean, if the families have to cope by changing their diet from having, a diverse diet that makes sure their children, you know, eat and have all the nutrients they need, something that's very carb heavy just to kind of fill calories, or, you know, or the adults have to skip meals or whatever, this kind of environment does not make children prone to, you know, to illnesses or whatever, but it affects, you know, if you want to be very technical, it affects their performance at school. But also, if a family can't afford to guarantee three good meals for every person at home, then what does that mean for them guaranteeing education for their children, all the costs that cover that, as Nadine said, because they got to pay for transportation, they have to pay for food, they have to pay for stationery and other costs. So also, I think the food security crisis, even in the early stages, was sort of the shape of things to come for what our economic crisis really is. It wasn't an annoyance, it wasn't an inconvenience, but it's actually going to shatter households and make the lives of children much worse, to a point where it's going to take a generation, I think, to make up for the damage. And I guess at that point, I noticed that more humanitarian agencies like Save the Children began to sort of intervene with Lebanese households on a much more sort of, like, you know, humanitarian response at greater numbers and in greater capacity. Whereas before, I think most of the response was mostly about helping with job creation, skills, and livelihoods. But now, suddenly, most of these humanitarian agencies are realizing that there are so many Lebanese households they need to support more than ever. And I guess this is where Save the Children was also very involved. So I want to hear about the response that you guys were involved in, and whether the food security crisis in particular sort of triggered a change in your response.
ب2019 كان بأولها حتى الأطفال برا المدارس، لأنه كانت المدارس عم بتسكر، طرقات منا آمنة ليوصلوا عليها. وحتى بعد ظهور كوفيد أو نشأة كوفيد كانت البلد كلها مسكرة. يعني عنا عيال أكتر خسرت شغلة، عنا أطفال، جميع الأطفال بلبنان يلي هن حسب تقديراتنا 1,200,000 طفل تأثروا بانقطاعهم عن التعليم. فهذا الولد هو بطل عم يقدر يوصل على المكان يلي أحيانا ممكن يأخذ فيه منه أكل، حماية، معلومات، نقدر نحن كمان نواكب تطورهم ونموهم وعلى أساسها نعطي الخدمة. وما في، يعني كنا بمحل بدنا الطريقة لحتى نوصل للأطفال الأكثر حاجة، وخاصة للأطفال ذوي الإعاقة يلي هن ما كانوا مشمولين بكيفية الوصول لخدمة التعليم بوقت ظهور كوفيد. فكان عنا مشكلة الوصول إلى، يعني، طرق التواصل مع العائلة بالتحديد، أما الأطفال موجودين معنا من خلال شركائنا على الأرض اللي هني موجودين بكل مكان منكون عم نعطي فيه المركز أو عنا فيه مركز خدمات، لأنه هني بيعرفوا أكتر طرق الوصول للعيال، يعني كانوا بيروحوا لعندهم دور تو دور. ومن خلال سؤالنا لهالمجموعات اللي كانوا موجودين معنا شو الطريقة الأفضل لأنه نتواصل معهم بحال ما قدرنا نروح لعندهم أو نفتح المراكز، وهون بلشنا نعمل response remote education. طبعا هي جديدة على الكل، شو remote learning، كيف بدنا نبلش بالريموت ليرنينج، لأنه هو أصلا حل قصير المدى هو مكان الأطفال بالمدرسة، لأنه التعليم هو نشاط اجتماعي، لازم يكون في تلاميذ، الولد عم فايت عبيئة صفية، عم يتعامل مع المعلمة أو الأستاذ إلى آخره. فدربنا هالمعلمين والمعلمات والكادر الموجود معنا على طرق توصيل خدمة التعليم حتى مع انقطاع أو تسكير المدارس بهيدا الوقت. لكن بيبقى خدمات الحماية، وخدمات الحماية هي صعبة تقدمها عن بعد. انت بدك تشوف تحكي مع الولد، تحكي مع العائلة، بدنا نشوف مصدر العنف على الولد من وين. وانت ما بقى بس عم نقول في أزمة واحدة انه هو الطفل خارج التعليم، الطفل أهله ما عم يقدروا يأمنوا له أكل، أصلاً منه قادر يوصل لخدمة التعليم، الخدمات الصحية كل الوقت بالبيت، يمكن موجود، يمكن يكون موجود ببيئة غير آمنة، يمكن يكون على الشارع كل الوقت إلى آخره. حتى أرقام الأمن الداخلي بلبنان أرجت قد صار في ازدياد بحالات العنف الأسري وحالات العنف على الأطفال والزواج المبكر يلي رصدته الجمعيات اللي بتشتغل بهذا المجال. طبعا بهيدي الأزمة الجديدة انت بحاجة لتكون عم بتزود الأهل بمعلومات او ببديل لكيفية التعامل مع ان كان المعلومات الصحية يلي هي ممكن تخليهم كمان على قيد الحياة ويحافظوا على أمنهم الصحي وأمن الأطفال الموجودين معهم، ووين بتكون متوفرة هيدي الخدمات. يعني حتى مشاركة المعلومات على المستوى الأول هو بصب بمصلحة الطفل لأنه يكون محمي أكثر بهذا الإطار. وأيضا الأنشطة يلي من إلا من الحزم يلي بنستعملها هي healing through art and education. هيدول الأنشطة هي بتعطي بديل للأهل أو let's say مورد زيادة كيف نقضي هيدا الوقت بشكل يكون الولد عم يستمتع فيه، الأهل عم يستمتعوا بتقضية الوقت مع طفلهم، وأيضا بتمكن الطفل من اكتساب هالمهارات، المهارات العاطفية الاجتماعية اللي بحاجة لها حتى يستمر ويتعامل مع هالعدة صدمات، هالعدة أزمات يلي عم بتمر بنفس النهار على كل العائلة، وبالأكثر يعني أكثر بتأثر على الطفل إذا ما كنا عم نشتغل معه على الصعيد العاطفي الاجتماعي. فكنا أيضا عم نبعث رسائل وأنشطة للأهل بكيفية تنفيذ الأنشطة، تواصل اليومي عبر هيدي المجموعات. وبتذكر الحلقة لك هي حتى لو كانت intervention قصير المدى، كان الشيء اللي بحب يضل حتى من بعد كوفيد هو إدخال الأهل، إشراك الأهل بالعملية التعليمية مع الأطفال. لأنه في أحد الأميات قالت أنا ما كنت قادرة، يعني قبل ما تعلمت وقتها كنا عم نبعث هيدي الأنشطة على التليفونات كان الأهل هني يبعثوا لنا الفرد أنه هني حالينه، يعني عم يتعلموا مع أطفالهم. وطبعاً ما فيني أمن خدمة التعليم عن بعد من دون ما أمن مثل ما ذكرت مواد لا يعني كتب كرتسية، أوراق، ريتشارج كاردز، سهولة الوصول لخدمات الإنترنت حتى يقدروا يضلوا معنا. لأن حي مثل ما ذكرت الصبية حيختاروا بين أنه منحط أكل على الطاولة ولا منشرج التليفون تنبعت ولد واحد، وبأغلب الأحيان كان في تفضيل طفل عن الباقي الأطفال اللي هن عندهم امتحانات رسمية لاستخدام هيدا الهاتف وإلى آخره. وكل شيء يعني الخدمات اللي بتنعطى هي متكاملة، ما في فريق واحد يكون فيها ولا في جمعية واحدة تكون فيها. ما نكون عم نشتغل على صعيد السيستم من خلال سياسات بتضمن حماية هالأطفال والوصول حقهم بالوصول إلى جميع الخدمات، وخاصة الأطفال ذوي الإعاقة بالتساوي مع الجميع، وتكون الخدمات متاحة وذات نوعية وجودة. وأيضا الشغل على مستوى العائلة والبيت والمجتمع، لأن أنه ما فيك تأمن بيئة سليمة وآمنة للطفل إذا اشتغلت على منحة واحد.
Absolutely. And what also came to mind is that, you know, this whole intervention from humanitarian agencies and from very, you know, local community initiatives that I sort of witnessed, I mean, they were the only ones that existed. Right. So, you know, when we look at, you know, the government response to COVID in different places, you had places where you had some sort of compensation, you had one-time cash payout, sort of like an unemployment kind of payment. None of that really happened here. There were some rollouts, you know, distributing bread and some cash and some stuff here and there, but it wasn't systemic. If things were as bad as they were back then with everybody's interventions, I mean, I could imagine that. So many families must have been really well taken care of at this point. That would have been neglected otherwise, I think. No, I don't think a lot of people understand how art can be very cathartic. And I think this is where I'd like to hear more from Nadine, who probably know better than all of us the role of art and catharsis.
When I was working on Capernaum, people used to ask me how are you dealing with it? How is it psychologically for you? And I remember back then, I felt very strong because I felt that I was on a mission. And that mission was, you know, trying to shed the light on this problem through my art, through my tool, which was at that point, it still is filmmaking and making films. So it is cathartic in some way. And it, because I truly believe in our responsibility as artists in the world that we are bound to build together. And I truly believe, you know, when you know how much art creates empathy, it becomes a responsibility, because you know that it will affect other people's perceptions. So when you are aware of that, it becomes a responsibility. And then you can't go back to just, you know, just making another film just for the entertainment part of it. It becomes a mission. It becomes a true mission. And when you know how much art has influenced so many, you know, movements across the world historically, so many uprisings, so many changes, so many systemic changes were initiated sometimes by a work of art, it becomes more and more a responsibility. So I perceive it as a mission, especially when you live in this part of the world where everything needs to, you know, needs to be changed and everything needs to be reshuffled and nothing is going the way it should. And when you are aware of how much art also can, you know, tackle or work or talk to your emotional cords, and this is where you are really able to move mountains. It's really when all your emotions are also, how can I say, affected, is really where you start wanting to change the world and you start wanting to and at least dream of changing the world and really believing in it. When you are working on something and you know it's going and you know you are on this sort of a mission, no matter what the result is or no matter where you get, it's the journey that is really the most empowering. And this journey is really when you are working on something that you truly believe in and you have this dream every day of waking up in the morning and going on this mission and trying to change the things that are frustrating around you and not just being cynical about it and not just, you know, surrendering. Frustration that you are feeling turns into your fuel, becomes your fuel, and you start wanting to do something about it. And suddenly it becomes a work of art, and this art impacts other people's, you know, perceptions and lives sometimes. So, yeah, it is, at least for me, it is very therapeutic and cathartic, and it gives me wings.
I love what you said. The moment you realize how much you can impact people through art, then it becomes a responsibility. And what your film did and what a lot of art does is it humanizes the problem. So instead of you seeing these refugees, for example, as numbers, as statistics, and they are doing something illegal, therefore you think of them as unlawful or criminals, you suddenly start to see the person behind it, and you start to see the story, and you start to see why they had no choice but to seek asylum, and why they would, if it was an option for them to have their old lives back, they would happily take it. But that life doesn't exist anymore. And about the injustice. So yes, I agree with everything you said about how much you can move people's emotions and they can watch your piece of art and then walk away and want to make change because it fuels them. And that is just a way to say how much art is powerful, and then realizing that just makes you want to use that tool to make change in the world.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, I remember in the beginning of the economic crisis in Lebanon, most of the conversation was just numbers. You know, what's happening in the banks? What's happening with the currency? But very little people ever spoke about, well, what does this mean for people's lives? What does it mean for children to be able to go to school? What does it mean for families to be able to afford food the way they once did? So it's really important to put a human face on everything, because even when things were looking very grim, but the entire discourse was purely based on numbers, without looking at how it actually affects families, I think people actually began to mobilize much more to support these families once there was a human face to the economic crisis, which wasn't there in the beginning. It was seldom part of the conversation. And I argue that ignoring sort of, you know, what the human angle or what their lives were like or their aspirations, actually getting to know vulnerable communities, whether refugees or not, you know, I think if we don't do that, then they will perpetually be, you know, second-class citizens. You know, we will never be able to make sure that they are treated equally as human beings if we don't portray them as such. And I think this is something that's very important. I think art plays a huge role in doing that. So on August 4th, 2020, the Beirut port exploded. And it was probably one of the most devastating moments in Lebanon's recent history. Hundreds of tons of ammonium nitrate that was stored in the port for 6 years was ignited. It flattened several neighborhoods in Beirut. It killed over 200 people, wounded over 6,500, and left hundreds of thousands homeless. It was, you know, truly an apocalyptic scene that night. Hospitals were destroyed, and it was as if the city had a complete facelift in a matter of seconds. And to this day, families are still grieving their lost ones, and they don't know what happened, and they don't know what justice looks like. And of course, it made the lives for so many families, even who survived, very difficult, because it aggravated the existing economic crisis. I recall going to hospitals that were completely destroyed. Patients were being treated on the floor, on the desk, outside on the sidewalk, it was absolutely devastating to see what happened. You know, and I think it's safe to say that everybody in Beirut feels like to be alive, because if I was where I was the day before the blast, I wouldn't be here right now talking with you, with all of you. It's absolutely horrifying, and I can imagine that it took everybody by surprise. And Nadine, I wonder if you're also very shocked by what happened, and whether you feel that shock sort of inspired you to work on that movie about the Beirut blast.
You know, obviously, of course, like everybody else, I was shocked for a while. It's a mixture of lots of different things: shock and anger and frustration and guilt. Because at that moment, I was not in my house in Beirut, so obviously we were able to survive, but other people didn't. So you have to deal also with this guilt feeling of why did we survive where others didn't. And so it was a mixture of lots of different very negative emotions. But then at some point you have to turn again this frustration and this righteous anger to a sort of you need to do something about it. You can't just, I couldn't just stay angry and just surrender. So I thought, I mean, what happened in Beirut was a crime against humanity, I think. And it was not just another accident, you know, whether it was an accident or an attack, it was the result of pure negligence. And this negligence cannot just, you know, go unpunished. So for me, I needed to just show it and say it, you know, this, what happened in Beirut was very similar to a nuclear explosion, less the radioactivity. So imagine something like this happening somewhere else in the world. How would people have have reacted. Of course, everybody was outraged, but I don't think it was enough, and I still think it's not enough. So for me, it was a reaction to just make a film and put it out there and show the enormity of the disaster. So I sort of tried to gather as much as I could, everything that was on the internet and those most horrific images, and then make a film. And then I wanted to ask somebody who has an international reach, an international voice, to just speak about it, because it's a different story. I just wanted, you know, the whole world to acknowledge and see the atrocities. And I still believe, you know, I'm still waiting. We are all still waiting in a way for the whole world to be outraged. And I think, I don't remember who said it once, that justice will never be served until the people who are not affected are as outraged as the people who are. And we are still, I think, waiting for the world to be as outraged as we are, because this is a crime against humanity, and it cannot go, you know, unpunished. And my hope is that, of course, one day we will be able to know the truth, and we will be able to hold the right people accountable. And I think that this is where we can start really thinking about rebuilding our nation, our country, and our lives, and, you know, reshuffling everything from the start, and until, you know, all this Machiavellian ruling class is all toppled down, we will be able to do anything. I don't know why. What was the question? Sorry.
Whether, I mean, a crime of this magnitude drove you to do that film, and I think you explained it fantastically, Nadine.
Yeah. For me, just trying to sort of do, I don't know, whatever was in my power at that point, which was to show as many people as possible the amount of the atrocities that happened. And I mean, imagine this happening somewhere else in the world, in France or in the States, or what would have the world done? I don't think we are there yet. I can't imagine that we're still begging for the truth right now.
I mean, it was one of the largest non-nuclear explosions in history. And then even those who survived, their lives completely changed. Like hundreds of thousands of people, they lost their homes, right? Which means that now, from struggling to maintain the life they once had as a family able to make ends meet, they're now trying to figure out how to live day by day. Yeah. And this is a huge issue that many people faced, even if they survived. And I think there was a huge role that civil society and community organizations played in trying to not just help, you know, rebuild homes, but to help people get by and live their lives again. And I think at that point, that's when Impact Lebanon came in with a humanitarian response. And that was shared, you know, I mean, that went viral. I mean, you guys had money pouring in from all corners of the world. So I'd like to hear more about that, Agatha, how it happened and what we were able to do with all that.
Yeah, so truly the generosity that was shown on that day and throughout that week and the following weeks was just humbling. So what we did as Impact Lebanon, obviously being in London, we felt like the only thing we could do was start a fundraiser. And we had no expectations about where it would go. I remember the first target was only £10,000. And then within minutes, we'd reached it. And by midnight, we'd reached $1 million. And by the end, we raised $9.2 million. Obviously, that is due to a huge amount of empathy and generosity that came not just from Lebanese people abroad, but also from non-Lebanese people abroad, because like Nadine said, it was a crime against humanity as humans, wherever we are. So this was not just another bomb in the Middle East. You know, this was something against humankind. And yeah, and that was reflected in the and just how much people wanted to help. So we spent a lot of time, us as Impact Lebanon volunteers, which, by the way, Impact Lebanon is 100% run by volunteers. So we spent a lot of time trying to figure out the best ways through partnerships. We had a brilliant amount of help from our partner Life in London, who helped us to disperse the funds here. And then we have a huge, very hardworking vetting team. So the way we did it is we decided what verticals we wanted to spend the funds on. So residential rehabilitation, hospital and medical care, mental health care, micro, small and medium businesses, livelihood support and heritage buildings. So the importance was to make sure that the gap is addressed. So we had an analysis to see where all the other organizations were spending their efforts and their funds to make sure that the gaps, to see where the gaps are biggest and most needed on the ground. Then we started the very thorough vetting process. You may have seen on our social media channels, the one-year summary report came out, which you can see on our Instagram and on our website at impact.lebanon. And you can read all the information about how we raised the funds, where we disbursed them, who we selected, how the vetting process went.
Yeah, it was completely a fantastic effort. And I remember it was one of the most, I think, supported efforts. And I think people had a lot of trust in what Impact was doing and the process it had.
Thank you.
And I believe that Save the Children was providing sort of mobile cash assistance. This was a time where, you know, while things were going to take time to be rebuilt, people needed immediate cash to secure food, medicine, and to pay rent wherever they are, and to maintain some sort of dignified life at that point of crisis. How did tell us more about it and how you were able to kind of just devise it so quickly?
خلال انفجار بيروت كان يعني حتى الأشخاص اللي كانت تشتغل بمكتب جمعية إنقاذ الطفل تعرضوا يعني كانوا بنفس محل الانفجار وأيضا عنا زملاء انصابت زملاء انجرحت زملاء دمروا بيوتها فلو مكتب بيروت الميداني هو اللي بيستجيب للمنطقة الجغرافية اللي طلع فيها الانفجار فبهيدا النهار كان الفريق فقط عم بيحاول يحصي مين من الأشخاص اللي عايشين بهالنطاق الجغرافي هن بعدهم أنه صابون شي عايزين أي خدمة لحتى تاني نهار من الساعة 9 بتذكر كان الإزاز بعده بأرض البيت عنا ما حدا توانى على أنه يكون جاهز لنبلش خطط الاستجابة بنفس النهار كنا عم نستلم اتصالات من فريقنا بالشمال فريقنا بزحلة والمكاتب الأخرى يلي منا تابعة لنفس النطاق الجغرافي لتنزل وتبلش بخطط الاستجابة بالاستجابة الطارئة لأنه ما عندك وقت بين أنك تحط خطة وتنزل تطبقها كان هالقد الفريق سريع بأنه ننقل مكتبنا من محل كله إزاز لمحل نقدر نقعد كان مثل محل الشيء اللي بعزيه الوحيد هو ينزل على المناطق المتضررة جدا ويقوم بمسح الاحتياجات ويعطي الخدمات اللي بنعطيها ومنها المالتي بيربس كاش اسيستنت هو صعب لمجرد انك تفكر فيها من ناحية فردية انه انت يمكن قادر ماديا عندك الشغل بعدك ما خسرته بعد كل هالازمات المتعددة بس برضو مرقت بالفكر ولادي منيح بيتي يمكن وقع 4 شبابيك تسوكي بكفي حياتي بس على الأرض المشهد كان جدا صادم في عالم خسرت أرواح في أولاد ماتت في عيال تشردت في أهل ضيعوا أولادهم المشهد كان جدا مأساوي على الصعيد النفسي أنه نكون بعضنا موضوعيين بعمل الاستمارة للعيال نشوف شو الخدمات اللي هن بحاجة لها بالمناطق الجغرافية اللي نحن مسؤولين عنها، وخاصة المساعدات المالية الوقتية، لأنه المساعدات المالية هي منا حل دائم. بس بهيك أزمة طارئة يجب أنه يكون عنا سرعة بتلبية هيدي الاحتياجات لحتى العائلة تقدر تستفيد منها، إذا كانت بدل الخدمة الأساسية لتضل على قيد الحياة خدمة صحية، أكل، شرب، مأوى، أجار، لأنه ما بقى وين بتروح؟ يعني أمنت وين بتطلع؟ ما هي مدينة بأكملها تدمرت. سو كنا أول شيء عم نبلش بس بالمالتي بيربس مالتي كاش أسيستنت أم بي سي أي، وبعدين فرق البقية كانت عم تحول على الخدمات يلي الأطفال بحاجة إلها والعيال بحاجة إلها، مثل حماية الطفل، مأوى يلي هو بيختص بإعادة التأهيل، السلل الغذائية حتى الأطفال والعيال يقدروا يأمنوا قوتهم اليومي. وطبعا ما كنا لحالنا، كنا من خلال شركائنا بالمكاتب الميدانية.
Yeah, I think one sort of uplifting thing that we saw next day was a mosaic of people from around the country, even people who had lost a bit but who still had the ability to go try and provide support. And just like with so many other things, it's a repetitive theme, but you know, there was virtually little to no state assistance, unfortunately, and it shows the vulnerability of the country. And I think Beirut blast sort of exposed that quite a bit. And I think, and I might be wrong, and so correct me, but I feel that many countries around the world still see Lebanon as a middle-income country. They don't understand that Lebanon is going through an actual poverty crisis. It's not just about, you know, skills anymore or creating jobs. It's really about helping people get food and medicine. Right now, people queue up at the gas stations for a long time. Medicines are going missing in pharmacies. So people are trying to, are literally posting on social media, asking their friends, can someone bring me this from abroad or that? People are stuffing their suitcases with painkillers, ibuprofen, female hygiene products, multivitamins, diabetes medicine, right? We are really facing, you know, a humanitarian crisis, and not because of sort of natural disaster. It wasn't a hurricane or an earthquake. This is bad economic policy and complete neglect. It's completely avoidable. And what's happening now, I think, is that you have two vulnerable communities, whether it's the poor Lebanese or the poor Syrian refugees, and they're kind of settling it with each other. And it must be trauma after trauma for everybody. And I think I'd like to start with Nadine, because, you know, Nadine, through Farnaoum, you were able to look through what life is like as a refugee child. You know, these aren't people who are trying to take people's jobs. They're people who fled trauma under the bombings of whatever participant in the conflict. And they come here to Lebanon and they're seen as a threat. And, you know, what is life for a refugee based on what you've seen in recent years?
You know, of course, we cannot generalize, but most of the kids I've met, unfortunately, have a very, very, very difficult life. And I mean, I don't need to explain it. Everybody knows. Because they are in a situation, like I said, they're in this standby situation where they can't access education the right way. They have to work, lots of them have to work to be able to sustain their families. So most of them are not educated. I've met children, and because of this whole difficult and struggling situation, and because our systems are unable to find solutions, I mean, they are paying the highest price. It's their birthday. They have never celebrated their coming into this world. Nobody's ever told them, you are precious to my eyes. I am celebrating the day you came into this world. So for them, in their own eyes, and I'm not blaming the government, I'm not blaming the parents or the family. The government obviously is the first one to blame, and our governments, our systems, where are not finding any solutions for those problems, are the ones to blame.
If you consider the trauma and difficult conditions that they live in and their families, and now you have the increased economic devastation and trauma that Lebanese families are facing, These are environments where I think racism and xenophobia, will grow exponentially. And this is this is why it's really important. I think there needs to be efforts to diffuse these kinds of tensions within Lebanese and Syrians and others in our community. And this is why we wanted to ask where Impact and Save the Children have tried to partner up to support both vulnerable communities as a way to diffuse that tension.
Shall I go? So there's a very exciting collaboration. There's two very exciting collaborations going on between Impact Lebanon and Save the Children. The first one is called Pathways to Success, which we've announced recently, and it's a long-standing collaboration to help children, specifically through EduPact, to help them gain access to quality education and be in a safe environment, and then also to make sure that they don't miss out on a lot of education because they can't afford to go to school or because of COVID or because they can't afford to have a laptop. Or so it's kind of like to help them catch up. And Save the Children is offering their amazing expertise in safeguarding, and they're offering safeguarding sessions to the teachers that are volunteering under EduPact to make sure that they carry those sessions in a safe and efficient way. And then the second very exciting collaboration is Bloom. And that is an initiative that aims at encouraging the entrepreneurial spirit of people. So the aim is to try to reduce the income gap and try to help people who have an idea to learn how to start their own business and to give them all the training and all the business knowledge that they need and all the, you know, the confidence that they need, the skills as well to start their businesses, so that we have more and more small businesses and micro businesses that are starting up and people are able to make an income despite being in difficult situations.
Thank you. شرحتهم كلهم, بس I will go back to what Nadine said. على بس نشوف الطفل مثل بنقولها بالعربي منمل, ما في أي reaction, ما عم يعطينا أي نوع من المشاعر. كل هيدي الأزمات يمكن بوقتها تعطيني شيء ظاهر يلي هو إذا كان الأذى جسدي أم جوع, بس على المدى الطويل بيكون عنا invisible scars إذا ما كان موجود ضمن البرامج برامج التدخلات أم الاستجابة, برامج خاصة فقط بالصحة العقلية والدعم النفسي الاجتماعي, منكون نحن ما عم نحل الناتج, يعني الأسباب يلي بتخلي الولد يسقط يمكن بالمدرسة, يتسرب من المدرسة, يخف التركيز عنده. إذا نحن كبار كنا كتير مزعوجين أو معرضين لتوتر, ما بنقدر نتعامل مع الموقف أو بيبين علينا دغري, وبحاجة للتعامل مع هيدا التوتر لعدة مهارات عاطفية اجتماعية, مهارات عقلية, لحتى اجمعهم سوا, حلل, فكر, استخدم المعارف اللي عندي اياها وارجع استجيب للوضعية اللي أنا موجودة فيها أو للموقف اللي عم حاول حله. كيف إذا كان طفل العنف هو من كل شيء حوالي, من السيستم, من عدم الحصول على هالخدمات, من حرمانه من أدنى حقوقه. نحن ما عم نحكي بعد ما وصلنا للرفاهية وحق المشاركة, بعدنا عم نقول الولد يأكل يعيش ببيئة آمنة, ما في حوالي ضرب, خبيط, إهانات, حقه بالجنسية, حقه بالبيت. كل هولي واحدة منهم كفيلة بأن تخلي الطفل لبعدين يكون عنده هالإنفيزيبل سكارز وهالتأثير لهيدا التروما ما بيروح. يعني فينا نرجع نفوت ندمج الطفل بالبرامج التربوية أو التعليمية, لكن ما منقدر نغض النظر عن هالدعم يلي بحاجة له الطفل على الصعيد النفسي والعاطفي أو الخدمات المختصة إذا كانت الصدمة هي مثل For example, بعد انفجار بيروت لاحظنا أطفال عم بيكون عندها تبول لا إرادي فجأة، لاحظنا أطفال ما عم بس بدها تنام بتخاف عم بتكوبس، أطفال فقدوا القدرة على النطق بشكل وقتي، فلاش باكس دايما عم نحكي بالميموريز يلي قطعت قدامنا. هول إذا ما استجبنا لإلهم أو ما عالجناهم خلال فترة كتير وجيزة بيتركوا عنا invisible scars بتأثر على حياتنا اليومية. كيف إذا عم أحكي عن طفل أصلا ما عنده القدرات أو المهارات اللازمة ليتعامل بهذا الوضع الصعب إذا ما كان equipped فيها وما كنا عم نشتغل عليها. بس كما بدي دوي على mental health and psychosocial support بالبرامج، هرجع بلش من حد ما أغاثا حكت عن بلوم. فكرة بلوم هو نهج تبعته جمعية إنقاذ الطفل ببلش as a seed fund، يعني بذرة صغيرة ودنقة بلومز. بيشتغل على ثلاث مستويات. أول مستوى هو تأمين هالمبلغ المالي الضئيل عبر something called crowdfunding، ونحن منقدم أو نحن والشركاء تدريبات خاصة بالمهنة لرائدي الأعمال ومنتورشيب متابعة خلال هذا البرنامج. هول ثلاث مستويات لأي يافع أو اليافعين الشباب الشابات يلي عندهم فكرة بزنس رائدة خلاقة مبدعة وبدهم مساعدة أنه يحصلوا على تمويل لهذه الفكرة. منقدر نأمن لهم هالبلاتفورم يلي من خلاله بياخدوا تدريبات خاصة بتعامل تواصل الفعال، اللغة الثانية، استعمال الحاسوب، كل شيء خاصه بالكمبيوتر. بس هولي ما منعطيهم هيك، بيكون عاملين قبل دراسة للسوق، شو الأشياء المطلوبة، شو الشغل المطلوب المرغوب، كيف منسوق عملنا إلى آخره. من خلال هالتوجيه المهنة لرائدين الأعمال يلي هن أصلاً عندهم الأونرشيب، أنت ما عم تجي تعطيهم مساعدة مادية أندتست لأنه هيدي وقتية، عم بتقلهم أنتوا شو عندكم أفكار لتشتغلوا، من كان من الجنسية اللبنانية السورية أم غير جنسيات على الأراضي اللبنانية، وعم تخلق له هالفرصة ليطور هيدي المهارات وترجع تعطيه التمويل ليقدر يستمر فيها وينفذها. في الخطوة الثالثة يلي هي البير كوتشينج والمنتورشيب. سو بده يدور بهالنتورك بهالشبكة اللي اليافعين موجودين فيها على شخص عنده نفس الأفكار أو الشغل أم المهنة أو المشروع يلي الشاب أم الشاب بيختاروه، ويكونوا عم بيساعدوا بعض ويتعلموا من خبرات بعض لحتى يتمكنوا بالسايكل الجديدة أو بالسنة الجديدة للبرنامج بأنه يكونوا هن عم بيدربوا عدد أكبر من اليافعين. فمنكون عم نخلق خط مستدام أم طريقة مستدامة، والشباب هن الجزء الفاعل بمجتمعهم وبالسوق العمل الاقتصادي وبتأمين المعيشة بالطريقة الصحيحة. قطعت الكهرباء ونادين طلعت.
I think قطعت الكهرباء. It looks like the electricity went out. I think that's why the internet died. We'll give it a
second. The only question I had left was for Nadine anyway. The only question left was for Nadine anyway.
Which was what?
Looking forward for the future.
What did she dream?
Of course, like everyone else, we all want justice. We all want the truth. I don't think we should be begging anymore for the truth. My hope is that one day we'll be able to hold the right people accountable for what happened on August 4th. I think we need this in order to be able to really rebuild our lives and our country.